was the attacker's first victim, but she might be the first time he acted out his fantasy. He clearly had a plan when he abducted her. Will listened to Sarah call out all of the details she had found in Jeffrey's boxes. He could tell she was upset. He wondered if this was hard for her because she knew the victim, or because she knew what it felt like to be raped. Sarah continued, "The day after Tommy was assaulted, Sybil Adams called me at the clinic. This was late morning before lunch. I met Sybil and Tommy at the medical center down the street. The emergency room wasn't much at the time. The hospital has since been closed, but they had most of the equipment that I needed and the privacy so that I could help Tommy. I have to say that this was one of the worst sexual assaults I've ever seen. The girl would have bled to death if Sybil hadn't insisted on calling me for help." Faith sat back in the desk. Will could see her gripping her pen. Sarah said, "I'm on thin ice here because Tommy was my patient. I have a lot of personal information that has to remain confidential. At the time she was interviewed, I was given her verbal permission to discuss her assault with the police, so long as nothing was formally filed. What I can tell you is what was transcribed into the notebooks that I read last night." Will could tell she was avoiding saying Jeffrey's name. Sarah put on her glasses. She referenced notes as she told them. "Tommy was orally, vaginally, and anally raped. Three of her back molars were broken. There were several anal fissures and bruising up into the colon. The majority of the blood came from the cervix, the head of the uterus that acts as a bridge to the vagina. She was on the verge of prolapse, where the vagina was falling out of its normal position. The rectovaginal septum was perforated. The small bowel had herniated into the back wall of the vagina. This is called a fistula. Bowel contents were leaking into her vagina. That's what Sybil smelled. She knew that it was more than Tommy's period." Faith's mouth opened. She couldn't find her breath. "Did you fix it?" "I'm not that kind of surgeon. And even if I was, the tissue was too damaged to immediately repair. Tommy had to wait 4 months before she was healed enough for the surgeries to begin. When we interviewed her, she was recovering from the first two procedures. There was a series of 8 operations involving a urologist, a neurologist, a gynecologist, and a plastic surgeon."
4 months? Faith asked. "She lived like that for 4 months?
"Yes." Sarah took off her glasses. Her pained expression made Will's chest ache. "During my initial treatment, my primary goal was to control the bleeding, then to make her as comfortable as possible. I wanted to have her immediately transported to a trauma center. She refused. Tommy was legally an adult, so she had a right to decline treatment. I finally talked her into letting me call her mother. Both of her parents came to the hospital. Tommy would not allow me to call an ambulance. She insisted that her father drive her to Grady."
"Jesus," Faith said. "That's more than 2 hours away."
She was stabilized. I administered morphine and steroids. I spent as much time as I could removing splinters from the soft tissue. Infection was my primary concern, especially with the bowel leak. I asked Tommy for permission to preserve the splinters. She refused. I visualized skin under her fingernails, where she had possibly scratched her attacker. She refused to let me collect it. I asked to take vaginal, anal, and oral swabs in case the attacker had left DNA. She refused. Will rubbed his jaw. The cop side of him was frustrated, but the human side of him knew that sometimes the only way to get through a bad thing was to run away from it as fast as you could.
"Splinters," Faith said. "From what?"
Sarah held up another photograph. "This." Grant County, Wednesday. Chapter 14. Jeffrey's phone rang again as he drove onto campus. He'd told Frank to keep all discussions about finding Leslie Truong's body off of the phones and radios. When a seasoned detective told you something was bad, you knew it was really bad. Jeffrey didn't want details about the murder leaking out to the press. He had three victims now. Two of them were still alive. Barely. He looked at the phone. A Sylacauga number flashed on the screen. His mother was calling from her neighbor's phone. Jeffrey silenced the ringing, but not before Sarah saw the caller ID. If she got any satisfaction from knowing that his mother had called three times during the 15-minute drive from Avondale, she didn't show it. By silent decree, both he and Sarah had retreated to their separate corners. He had no idea what was going on in her mind right now. For Jeffrey's part, he was doing his best not to think about what Sarah had told him on the drive over. She had fallen back on dense medical jargon as she had relayed the physical ramifications of Tommy Humphrey's attack. Jeffrey had tasted blood in his mouth by the time she'd finished. He wanted to write down every word, to memorialize what had happened to the 21-year-old girl in case she ever got to the point where she felt strong enough to file an official complaint. Time was not on her side. The abduction alone was a felony charge, but Georgia's statute of limitations narrowed down her window for filing to 7 years. Rape was limited to 15 years. Unfortunately, Tommy had refused to allow Sarah to collect samples from the attack. The slivers, the buccal swabs, the fingernail scrapings. Any one of those pieces of evidence could have bought Tommy some breathing room. The law stipulated that the prosecution of kidnapping, aggravated sodomy, and aggravated sexual assault could commence at any time when DNA was used to identify the suspect. If 14 years from now, a defense lawyer asked why Tommy Humphrey had waited so long to come forward, and how she could be so sure about the details, Jeffrey wanted to be there with his dated and time-stamped notebook to cram the details down the asshole's throat. His phone rang again. He tapped the screen to put it on speaker.
What is it, Lena?
I found the guy going by the name Little Bit, she said. His name is Felix Floyd Abbott, 23 years old. He took off on his fucking skateboard. I had to chase him half a mile. He had a couple of dub sacks on him, just under the limit for distribution.
Book him. Let him stew. I'll get to him later.
Jeffrey ended the call. Felix Floyd Abbott, not Daryl, so he still needed to locate the man from Becky Catarino's phone book. He told Sarah,
Little Bit is the campus pot dealer.
Sarah nodded. Her hand rested on the door handle. Jeffrey was pulling into the staff parking lot. She was anxious to get this over with. He told her,
Thank you.
For what?
For helping with Tommy. For being here.
She could have said a lot of things that would have made him regret his appreciation. But Sarah only nodded. He parked the car. He looked at the time. Benita Truong's plane had landed 1 hour ago. She had texted Jeffrey that she was heading straight to Grant County as soon as she could rent a car. The woman had at least 2 hours of driving. He told himself it wasn't cowardice that kept him from calling her right now. Leslie's mother would want details. Jeffrey wanted to offer her as many as he could. Sarah got out of the car before he did. She walked over to Brock's mortuary van. He was pulling the white folded canvas tent from the funeral home out of the back. Frank was trying and failing to give him a hand. Jeffrey felt a sickness in his gut. Frank hadn't said anything about a tent. Yesterday's storm had reached the Carolinas. The scene was bad enough that they had already agreed that they needed to obscure the body.
Hey, Brock.
Sarah rubbed his arm.
I'm here if you want me. Don't feel crowded.
Oh, Sarah, crowd me all you want. This is something terrible. I'm not sure I can handle this job anymore.
You'll be fine.
She took the crime scene kit out of the van and looped the strap over her shoulder.
I'll help you as much or as little as you ask me to.
Jeffrey grabbed the stack of tent poles from Frank. Frank pointed into the woods.
Body's about 300 yards that away.
Jeffrey followed the general direction of Frank's finger. The area lined up with Kevin Blake's office window. He imagined the dean was already on the phone with the board, the school lawyers, and the mayor. Jeffrey didn't care what they were talking about. He wasn't worried about his job anymore. He was worried about catching the animal who had hurt these women. The town was his responsibility. So far, he had failed three victims. One who didn't trust the police to take care of her. One who had almost died while they stood around shooting the shit. And another who had been left to make the half-hour trek back to campus on her own and never made it. The death of Leslie Truong rested solely on his shoulders. Frank said,
Brad says she's dressed in the same clothes she was wearing yesterday morning at the Caterino crime scene. Yoga stuff, it looks like. Body's real cold and stiff. She was probably there all night.
Jeffrey felt ill. He looked at Sarah.
She said nothing, but for once he knew exactly what she was thinking. He told Frank,
I had 15 people out with me searching those woods. How did we miss her?
Frank shook his head, not because he didn't know the answer, but because the answer was obvious. The forest was sprawling. There hadn't been a moon last night. You could only see what you could see. Jeffrey tried again.
Felix Abbott. He goes by the name Little Bit. Do you know him? No, but Abbott's a Memminger name.
Frank shook a cigarette out of his pack.
All of them are doololly pieces of shit.
Doololly was the seedy intersection of two hopeless streets in Memminger County. The area was two counties over, so the occupants were not Jeffrey's problem. He had often heard the Memminger sheriff refer to some of the county's more idiotic offenders as a real doololly. Jeffrey said,
Caterino had a number stored in her phone for someone named Daryl. That name ever come up in connection to Felix Abbott? Daryl? No last name, just Daryl. Not ringing a bell, but you know my bell is from the Liberty Line.
Frank asked,
Why are you asking? You looking at either of them? I'm looking at the entire town.
Jeffrey watched Sarah gather the tent stakes and rope. Her jaw was tensed as they set off toward the crime scene. She had seen firsthand the damage to Tommy Humphrey. Of the four of them, only Sarah really understood what they might find deep in the woods. Brock shifted the heavy canvas tent onto his shoulder.
Sarah, please thank your mother for coming by last night. It was sweet of her to sit with Mama. Her asthma's been acting up something fierce. I'm afraid she'll end up in the hospital again.
Sarah rubbed his arm again.
You can call me night or day if she needs help. You know I don't mind.
Thank you, Sarah. That means the world to me.
Brock looked away. He used his sleeve to wipe his eyes. Frank said,
Truong was found by a student, Jessa Copeland. Matt's taking her statement back at the station. Tell him to stay with her until her family or a friend can take over. He knows.
Frank lit his cigarette. He was the only one of them who wasn't carrying anything. Considering his poor health and the 300-yard hike, that probably wasn't a bad idea.
Copeland, the one what found her, was running in the woods. She got turned around straight off the path. That's when she saw Truong. She recognized her immediately from the message boards. I came out with Matt and Brad. Brad's still with her. What does she look like? Same as Caterino. On her back. Clothes in place. She's got a mark here.
Frank tapped his fingers on the side of his temple.
Bright red. Circular, like the size of a quarter.
Sarah looked back at Jeffrey.
Like the head of a hammer. Frank said, "It was pretty obvious she was gone, but I felt for a pulse. Matt felt for one. Brad tried to, then he put his ear to her chest to make sure."
Jeffrey got to the bat.
"What else?" "Blood."
He indicated the lower part of his body.
"Everywhere."
Sarah asked, "Was she lying on an incline? Her pelvis lower than her chest?"
"Nope."
"Only two things make blood flow. Gravity and a pumping heart. She must have been alive for a while."
"Dear God," Brock murmured. "That poor broken creature."
Sarah looped her free arm through his. Brock was her age, but he was one of those men who had always presented himself as older. She talked to him in a low, soothing voice. Brock seemed relieved to have the comfort. Frank told Jeffrey,
"I might hang up my hat alongside Brock's after this one. There's another case, a living victim who might be connected to this."
Jeffrey wasn't going to share the details.
"We need to look at the sex offender list." "Easy peasy."
Jeffrey tried not to let Frank's sarcasm get to him. The GBI was mandated by law to maintain a searchable database of registered sex offenders, but the legislators, in their wisdom, hadn't allocated additional money or resources to make that happen. The backlog was tremendous. Some of the rural counties were still using dial-up to go online. The Department of Justice had found the state's records deficient almost from the outset. That didn't mean they shouldn't try. Jeffrey told Frank,
"Pull somebody off patrol and sit them down in front of a computer."
"Why don't I hang one more exit sign on the Titanic while I'm at it?"
"You got any better options?"
Jeffrey demanded. They had no clues, no suspects, and their only possible witness was lying dead at their second crime scene.
"What did Chuck Gaines say?"
Frank made a face.
"He came down here swinging his dick around. I told him to get the hell back to his cave. Matt's checking the security cameras, but there's no way this guy parked on campus. He must have come up the other side of the woods. Maybe the fire road?"
"She's been missing for over 24 hours.
Jeffrey took in his surroundings. The woods were dense. Ivy kept tangling around his shoes.
"Why do you think she was here all night?"
"I didn't see any ligature marks on her ankles or wrists. She's fit, young. She would have fought back. He would have tied her up."
Frank horked up some phlegm, then spat it out.
"I'm not a coroner, though, and I damn sure ain't a medical examiner. What happened yesterday, there's no way I would have said Katerina was anything but an accident."
Brock said,
"We're lucky you were there, Sarah. I'm not sure I would have asked the right questions either."
Jeffrey hated that he was thinking about the lawsuit Gerald Katerina might file, which meant that none of them should be tossing around what-ifs that they might later be compelled to explain in a deposition. He directed his thoughts back toward the case, remembering something Tommy Humphrey had told him, a detail that connected her attacker to Rebecca Katerino's. He asked Frank,
"Did you see anything blue on Truong, maybe around her mouth or on her throat?"
Frank stopped walking.
"How did you know?"
Sarah was paying attention now. She asked, "Know what?"
"Her lips had a blue stain here."
Frank pointed at his mouth.
"Reminded me of when Darla was little and she drank too much Kool-Aid."
Sarah caught Jeffrey's eye again. The stain wasn't from Kool-Aid. It was likely from blue Gatorade. That would explain why Truong's wrists and ankles showed no ligature marks. As with Tommy Humphrey, she'd been drugged during the attack. Frank asked,
"What am I missing?"
Jeffrey nodded for him to lead the way. They formed a single file line as Frank took them deeper into the forest. Jeffrey readjusted the tent poles to get a better hold. He silently reviewed what he knew about the attacks on Tommy Humphrey and Rebecca Catarino. He wanted to have the details at the forefront of his mind when they reached the body. The blue Gatorade. The woods. The university. The hammer. The attacker had used bleach on Humphrey. They were guessing that he'd used unscented wipes to clean up Catarino. That was a lot, but it wasn't enough. Jeffrey ran through the differences. Catarina was gay, Humphrey straight. One was a freshman, the other a junior. One kept to herself. The other had been surrounded by friends. The photos along the Humphreys' hallway had given him a good idea of what Tommy had looked like before the attack. She had been slightly on the heavy side. Her blonde hair was cut in a bob. In the group shots, she had appeared shorter than her friends. Catarina was very slight, almost too thin. Her brown hair was shoulder length. Her approximate height put her around 5'6". She was physically active, where Tommy had appeared to be more sedentary. As far as they knew, Rebecca hadn't suffered the same internal damage during her attack. Then again, maybe Leslie Truong had interrupted Katarino's assailant before he'd been able to mutilate her. Jeffrey needed to look at Lena's notebook again. She would have taken down the details from Leslie Truong before releasing her back to campus. Jeffrey had read Lena's official report, but her notebook could have a piece of information that might offer a lead. He was done giving her the benefit of the doubt. Jeffrey heard the soft murmur of Brad Stevens' police radio before he saw the young patrolman. Brad had cordoned off the area with yellow crime scene tape, the same as yesterday morning. A few students were milling around in the distance. They seemed to be inching forward. Some of them had cameras. Brad was keeping an eye on them. He looked more pale than usual. In the last 2 days, he had been exposed to more violence than he would likely see in his entire career, if he was lucky.
Chief?
Brad squared his shoulders.
Scene is secure. 3 of us verified her status as deceased.
Yesterday, did you check Catarina for a pulse?
No, Chief.
Brad was clearly struggling to look him in the eye.
I assume she was dead.
Jeffrey assumed Lena had told Brad that Catarina was dead and that there was no need for him to check. As the junior officer on scene, he would have obeyed her.
You saw Leslie Truong yesterday. Did you speak to her? Or was it just Lena's decision to let her walk back to campus on her own?
He
stopped, unable or unwilling to run Lena down.
I was there too, Chief. I didn't say anything. I'm sorry, it won't happen again.
Here.
Jeffrey handed him the tent poles.
Get some more yellow tape. Push the crime scene perimeter back another 50 feet. Call in 2 more officers for crowd control. Then start putting this tent together.
Yes, Chief.
Sarah knelt to place the tent stakes and rope on the ground. Jeffrey slipped the strap for the crime scene kit off her shoulder. He cupped his hand under her elbow so she wouldn't trip on the uneven terrain. The undergrowth was thick. Ferns and woody vines and sticker bushes picked at their clothes. The mud sucked around their shoes. Jeffrey could hear squirrels chattering at each other. He looked at the ground. Puddles from yesterday's rainstorm filled the dips and depressions in the soft earth. During his search the night before, Jeffrey had noticed the ground was saturated. His shoes had been caked with mud. The only footprints he could see now were the ones they had just made. Sarah was looking down at the ground. She had noticed, too. Yesterday morning, the clouds had broken open while they were waiting for the ambulance to arrive. Either the killer was a ghost who didn't leave footprints, or Leslie Truong had been attacked while she was making her way back to campus to see the school nurse. That left a 30-minute window. The same amount of time Rebecca Catarino had lain helpless in the woods.
Fucking Lena.
The wind shifted. The pungent smell of blood and shit assaulted his senses. Jeffrey put the back of his hand under his nose. Brock said,
"Her bowels must have released."
Jeffrey took the face mask that Brock offered. He knew that funeral directors dealt with the dead on a daily basis. Brock was trying to make sense of the scene, but this was nothing like tending to the body of an elderly nursing home patient who had soiled herself as she'd slipped away. Jeffrey put on the mask, but the odor still chewed at the air. Leslie Truong was lying flat on her back. She looked very young. That was Jeffrey's first impression. She had that childlike softness in her features that only age could wear away. Her eyes were open, staring blankly into the sliver of blue sky showing through the tree canopy. Her lips were parted. The blood in her face had started to drain to the back of her skull. Her skin was the color of parchment. The blue stain Frank had told them about stood out against the pinkish white of her lips. Sarah checked for a pulse. She rested her hand on the side of the girl's cheek. She checked the flexibility of the joints in her fingers and elbows. Peak rigor mortis generally occurs at 12 hours, then dissipates by 48. The temperature has been on the low side, which impacts the process. I need to take a liver temp, but my guess is that she's been dead for several hours, at least since yesterday morning. Since yesterday morning. Since Lena let her walk back to campus. Since a hammer-wielding psychopath had followed her through the woods. Jeffrey inhaled to calm himself, but coughed it out before his lungs could fill. The putrid smell had permeated the cotton mask. He focused his attention back on the victim in front of him. He was having trouble separating what Sarah had told him about Tommy Humphrey and what he assumed had happened to Leslie Truong. The similarities to Becky Caterina were there, too. Based on the position of Truong's body, you could make the assumption that she had stumbled in the woods, landed on her back, slipped into unconsciousness, then eventually died. Her clothing looked undisturbed. She was wearing a Grant Tech sweatshirt with a collar cut out. Jeffrey could see the straps of her white sports bra underneath. Her white yoga pants were pulled up to her hips. They were Lululemon, the same as the brand that Sarah wore. Truong's sneakers were blue Nikes. She wore ankle socks. That was where the similarities ended. Blood had flowed like a river between Leslie Truong's legs. Her white pants had been soaked through. The volume was such that even the rain could not wash it all away. Leaves and twigs had been blackened by the surge. She was not lying on a slope. The blood had poured as her heart frantically pumped out its last beats. Still, Jeffrey needed verification.
"Is this the murder scene?"
Sarah asked. "Are we assuming the window for the attack was roughly half an hour to 45 minutes?
Brock asked, "I'm sorry, Sarah, but for my notes, can you tell me where you got that time frame?"
Jeffrey answered the question.
"Leslie Truong left the scene of Caterino's attack around 6 yesterday morning. The rainstorm hit about half an hour later."
"Ah," Brock said. "The rain washed away the shoe prints."
Jeffrey asked Sarah,
"What do you think happened?"
"I need to see a weather report to pin down the exact time the rain started. But taking a rough guess, I can imagine 2 different scenarios," Sarah explained. "In the first scenario, Leslie was walking back to campus. She was abducted and taken somewhere close, but private, like the back of a vehicle. She was raped and murdered. Then the assailant brought her back here, probably in a fireman's carry over his shoulder, before the rain started." Jeffrey figured that was possible, but not likely.
"Second scenario?"
"The attack and murder happened here, and because of the storm, we're not seeing signs of a struggle." She made sure to include Brock. "Can you think of anything else?"
No, but I'd say the second one sounds more like what happened,
Brock said.
In an abduction situation, you'd think the suspect would get messy? If he carried her, I mean.
Sarah said, he would be covered in blood.
He's got to be a big fella to tote that gal so far, Brock said. I could barely carry that tent, and the canvas weighs 30, maybe 40 pounds.
Sarah sat back for a moment. Jeffrey could see that the smell was making her eyes glisten. She was breathing through her mouth.
Brock said, it's risky to abduct her and bring her back. And I guess it's risky to attack her in the first place. We're off the beaten path, but there's still a path.
Jeffrey didn't have to be told this killer was a risk taker. What little they knew about him pointed to a man who relished hiding in plain sight. He turned to Frank, who had been hanging back because of the smell.
I need a topographical map of this entire area. I want to see where that fire road is in relation to the scene. Whether or not he took Truong back to his vehicle or killed her here, he had to park somewhere.
Frank started to leave, but Jeffrey said,
get some more uniform officers out here. I want a grid search back to the fire road. No matter where she was attacked, he got here from somewhere. Let's expand our perimeter and make sure those spectators we saw aren't trampling on evidence. Remind the searchers to lift their heads up occasionally. Not everything is on the ground.
Got it.
Frank had his radio to his mouth as he walked away. Sarah was looking at Brock.
I can handle the filming if you want to do the visual exam.
No. You're the doctor. You should do the important parts.
Brock opened the crime scene kit. He reached for the ancient Sony camcorder, but the clunky device slipped from his hands.
Sorry. This is just so terrible.
It is, Sarah agreed. But we can take care of her together, all right?
Yes, you're right.
Brock checked there was a VHS tape in the camcorder. He took off the lens cap. He dropped it into his pocket. Jeffrey found his notebook and pen. They were all feeling unnerved. There was something about the volume of blood between Leslie's legs that told a story none of them wanted to learn. He thought about his previous phone conversations with Benita Truong. The woman had probably reached Macon by now. Jeffrey had told many parents over the years that their child had passed away, but he couldn't quite figure out what to say to the mother when she finally arrived. The truth would destroy her. The truth might destroy him.
Your daughter was brutally attacked. She was drugged. She was sexually assaulted. She was terrorized by a madman who left her in the woods, where she slowly succumbed to her injuries. And I should probably mention that all of this was preventable, but please don't let that get in the way of your grief.
Sarah slipped on a pair of exam gloves. She asked Brock,
ready?
He nodded, pressing the red button. The camcorder whirred to life. Sarah provided the date and time. She called out all of their names for benefit of the recording. Then she started the preliminary exam. She used a pen light to check the eyes.
No petechia.
The girl had not been choked or strangled. Sarah gently turned the head to better see the red mark on the temple. She told Jeffrey,
she had time to bruise. This could be the first blow. Based on the location, one strike could knock her cold. I'd say the weapon used is consistent with a hammer.
Brock took in a sharp breath. He turned his attention to the camera. He tilted the LED screen. He adjusted some of the settings. Jeffrey could see that his hands were shaking. Jeffrey's hands were still, but they were sweating profusely. The feeling of violence permeated the air. The smell was nauseating, even with the mask. Witnessing unnatural death came with a job, but something about this particular victim, this particular case, sent dread into every fiber of his being.
Jeffrey had hunted his share of murderers and rapists. He had never before hunted a predator. Sarah looked in the nostrils, inside the mouth. She pressed her fingers along the girl's throat. She said,
I'm not detecting any blockages.
Blockages? Brock asked.
Caterino had something in her throat, probably regurgitated pastry.
Brock nodded as he carefully stepped around the body.
Sarah turned the girl's head at a more severe angle to look at the back of the neck. Jeffrey saw dried blood around a tiny hole.
There's a puncture wound at C5, she said. That would have got the job done.
What job?
Brock asked. Jeffrey said,
We think the killer wanted to paralyze the victims.
Brock shook his head in disgust. Jeffrey could see a bead of sweat rolling down the side of his face.
Sarah worked her way down. She lifted the sweatshirt. There was bruising on the torso.
She was punched. It feels like one of the ribs was dislocated.
Jeffrey looked down at his notebook. The page was clean. He started a rough sketch of the body. He noted the location of trees and rocks. Sarah ran her finger under the waistband of the yoga pants. She told Brock,
Get closer on this.
Her exam gloves showed a red streak, but not from blood. Jeffrey recognized the distinct rust color of Georgia clay. Brock asked,
Could she have rolled over?
Maybe, Sarah said. Can we look at her back?
Jeffrey took the camera from Brock so that the man could glove up. It wasn't easy. The vinyl gloves kept getting caught on his sweaty skin.
Sorry.
Brock finally managed to yank the gloves down to his wrists. The band tore. Jeffrey could see an old scar on the inside of Brock's wrist.
Ready.
Brock knelt at the girl's head. He braced his hands on the shoulders. Sarah positioned her hands on the waist. They moved in tandem to rotate the girl onto her side. The waistband of Truong's pants was bunched up in the back. Dirt and twigs stuck into the bare skin of her buttocks. Sarah said,
Her pants were pulled up while she was lying on the ground.
Brock asked,
What do you think that means?
They carefully rolled the girl back to the ground. Sarah said,
It could mean he returned to the scene.
After he left her for dead?
Brock asked.
Why would he come back?
Sarah looked at the girl's hands. Her fingertips were stained red.
I suppose it's possible she pulled up her pants herself.
Jeffrey considered the implications. Leslie Truong bleeding to death in the woods, her hands reaching down to cover herself in a futile attempt at modesty. Sarah gently parted the legs. Jeffrey clenched his teeth at the smell.
The crotch of the pants is torn.
Sarah used the penlight again. She moved the legs farther apart. She told Jeffrey,
Zoom in.
He watched the LED screen as the camcorder's lens went into macro mode. The spandex between the girl's legs had been torn apart. He saw thick clots of dried blood and what looked like sharp slivers of glass shredding through the material, similar to an explosion caught mid-detonation. The pants had been ripped from the inside out. Brock asked,
What is that?
A wooden handle, Sarah said. He broke off the hammer inside of her.
Atlanta, Chapter 15. Faith stared at the picture of the broken handle. The photographer had laid it out on a piece of white paper with a ruler beside it for scale. The weapon had been cleaned, but blood and feces had soaked into the grain. The part where the head of the hammer would have been was splintered off. The wooden spikes jutted out like broken teeth.
Sarah said, The severed handle could only be removed by dissecting the vaginal vault. It was deep inside of her, far enough to fracture the bones of the pubic arch. Best guess is that the killer kicked the head of the hammer. It broke off at the thinnest point, which is the neck.
Faith had stopped breathing. She had to look away from the photograph. Sarah said, "There was a manufacturer's mark on the base of the handle. The hammer was of a type called a mechanic's or a machinist's hammer. The handle is wide at the bottom, then tapers up to the neck."
Will said, "That's the kind you use to beat out dents in car panels."
"Right," Sarah said. "It's got a flat head on one end, and the other end has a long peen tipped with a conical die. From my recollection, there was nothing special about it. You could buy it off the shelf or order it online."
"Recollection?"
Amanda asked.
"You didn't find the information in the reports."
"A copy of the autopsy report was in the files last night, but I don't have access to my personal notes. Those would be in Brock's files, along with toxicology, lab reports, measurements, and photos that were taken at the scene. By law, he was the coroner of record, so I was simply treated as an advisor to his office. We didn't want to break the chain of evidence."
Amanda said, "I want that information."
"I'll call him." Sarah went back to the autopsy. Leslie Truong had a puncture wound at C5. Based on films, the puncture is consistent with the circumference and length of the device that paralyzed Becky Catarino.
Amanda said, "And Alexandra McAllister, the White County victim who was autopsied yesterday, had the same type puncture, located at C5.
"What about the other stuff?" Faith asked. "Did McAllister have the fistula?"
"No, but she was violently raped. There were fissures around and inside of the vagina. The wall showed scraping with some type of sharp instrument. The clitoris had been ripped." Sarah paused, and Faith was grateful for the moment.
"From an investigatory standpoint, we got lucky," Sarah said. "The hiking pants McAllister was wearing were a heavy waterproof material. Normally, predators go for the orifices, so the murderer likely assumed that any damage he caused during the rape would be blamed on predator activity."
Faith had to ask, "The coroner didn't notice her clit was ripped off?"
"He didn't see a legitimate reason to perform a pelvic exam. He might have noticed during the embalming. Cotton is packed into the orifices to prevent leakage."
Faith could not suppress a shudder. Sarah continued,
"My visual exam of McAllister yesterday morning confirmed most of what the coroner found, which is that the death was accidental. Without x-rays, the head wound passed for a skull fracture from impact against a rock. It was only when I checked for a spinal puncture that I made the connection to Grant County. Had I not known what I was looking for, I might have missed it. Had I missed it, I never would have brought McAllister back here for a full autopsy."
The lesson in transparency was clearly meant for Amanda, who responded,
"Thank you for the chronology, Dr. Linton."
Sarah continued, "The theory in Grant County was that the killer was at the nascent stage. He saw each new victim as a learning opportunity to hone his skills. Tommy's attack was botched, for lack of a less appalling way to describe it. Becky lived. Truong did not. Now we fast forward 8 years. Alexandra McAllister's murder was convincingly made to look accidental. If you asked me to look at these four cases as a piece, I couldn't rule out the hypothesis that there is a clear line of progression from Tommy to Alexandra McAllister." Faith tapped her pen on her notebook. She needed more information.
"Are you saying that the mutilation is his signature?"
"Paralysis is his signature. We know that from the attacker's own words." Sarah provided, "He told Tommy to pretend to be paralyzed. He threatened to do it with the knitting needle if she didn't comply. With McAllister, I assume there was no negotiation. He punctured her spinal cord at C5. He enervated her arms. She would have been completely paralyzed, but still breathing, still awake. That was the state he was trying to effect with Tommy."
"Jesus."
Faith wrote paralysis in her notebook, but only to give herself time to recover.
"Dr. Linton?"
Amanda said.
Walk us through the other links.
The most tangible link that can be proven with X-rays is the head wound. Caterino's skull fracture was crescent-shaped. It matched the hammer. The red impression on the side of Leslie Truong's head matched the hammer that was found inside of her. When I autopsied Alexandra McAllister yesterday, her skull fracture was consistent with the head of a hammer. Faith wrote down the information as she asked,
What about Tommy?
She said that her attacker hit her with something very hard. She didn't see what it was. Amanda prompted,
And the next link?
8 years ago, Tommy told us that during her abduction, she was forced to drink a blue, sugary liquid consistent with Gatorade. Rebecca Caterino's vomit and throat contents had a visible blue coloring. During Leslie Truong's autopsy, I noted a blue liquid in her stomach. Yesterday afternoon, when I performed the full autopsy on Alexandra McAllister, I found a similar blue liquid in her stomach, plus staining in her throat and mouth. I've sent the sample off to toxicology. Faith asked,
Did the Grant County coroner,
Dan Brock,
did he get back the toxicology on Truong?
Brock sent all the samples to the GBI. Even with a rush, back then it usually took a few months to get results. I never asked to see them because at that point Daryl Nesbitt was the presumed perpetrator. Amanda started typing on her phone.
We should have copies of the labs.
Okay.
Faith needed clarification.
I get that there's a progression in his attacks where he's learning, and the hammer and the Gatorade make sense. But Caterino is an outlier. Hell, yes, she was damaged, but she wasn't mutilated like the other two victims.
If I may, ma'am.
Nick waited for Amanda to give him the nod.
One of the theories the chief and his team had was maybe he doesn't abduct them. Maybe he follows them into the woods. He knocks them out and carries them to a more secluded spot, usually off the beaten path. He drugs them into oblivion. He rapes them. He leaves them there, and then he comes back, doing more damage with each visit. Then the body gets found, and he has to look for a new victim.
Faith felt sick.
They are alive the whole time? Just waiting for him to return and hurt them again?
And paralyzed, Sarah said. They could live for 3 days without water, 3 weeks without food, but if he came back, who knows?
Ted Bundy returned to his victims, Faith said. If this killer is like Bundy, part of the excitement could be the fear of getting caught.
Nick, Amanda said, tell them about the profile.
Nick unsnapped his Liberace briefcase and pulled out a stapled stack of pages.
The chief asked me to get the FBI to do a profile. Y'all know stranger homicides are a bitch. We figured it had to be somebody in town who knew the layout of the forest and where the students hung out. The Phoebes sent this back a year later.
Faith didn't set much store by profiles. Not least of all because they tended to be generated by older white men with personal issues of their own.
Let me guess. He hated his mother.
They said his primary driver was daddy issues. Dad coasted through life, our killer did not. He was socially isolated. An okay student who never applied himself. Ended up working with his hands. Mid to late 30s, low self-esteem. Can't find a woman, let alone keep her. Felt like he was a lesser man, is where daddy comes in. The killer was seeking punishment, was how the Phoebes explained the risk taken of leaving the bodies hidden in plain sight, then coming back to them until they were found. I'm sure as hell not one of those the killer wants to be stopped kind of guys. I think killers never want to be caught. But this sick mofo was definitely taking some big-ass risks.
Amanda asked,
Sarah?
She said, I can see what they mean. Grant was a small, insular town. The killer was targeting young white women who were students, part of the community, with extended families. That's asking for a lot of scrutiny.
Nick said, he could have done his thing night and day in Atlanta with prostitutes and dumped their bodies in the Chattahoochee and nobody would have put any of it together.
Question.
Faith raised her hand.
If he has daddy issues, why didn't he kill men? And why the mutilation?
Because he hated his mother.
Bingo.
Anyway,
Nick continued,
the profile hits Daryl Nesbitt in the sweetmeats. Stepdad was a successful business owner, at least until the law caught up to him. He never formally adopted Daryl, so the kid felt unwanted. Mom was a speed freak who tricked herself out. She OD'd when Daryl was 8. He dropped out of high school at 16 and worked a series of menial jobs. He thought he was going to be Tony Hawk, but he ended up being a day laborer, taking cash under the table to get out of paying taxes.
Sarah said, I don't want to make sweeping statements, but the entire family was considered bad news. The stepfather's shop was busted a few years ago for stripping stolen cars for parts. Will said,
you'd need a machinist's hammer for that.
Correct, Nick said. All the evidence pointed right at Daryl Nesbitt. He lived in the vicinity. He had access to the hammer, which was a very particular type, even though it was readily available. He was connected to the victims. Motive, means, opportunity. He was all there.
Faith chewed at her tongue so she didn't counter with the obvious, which was that their suspect was still out there killing, so the evidence wasn't really evidence. It was more like a debunked alternate theory. She said,
maybe, in the beginning, the killer wanted to get caught, but then he realized that he could make it more exciting by getting away with it.
Will cleared his throat.
If he's really learning with each kill, then spreading his victims out all over the state is a smart move.
Faith said, Bundy did that, too.
Amanda gave her a stern look of warning. Faith shrugged. She could only say the truth, and the truth was they were talking about a serial killer.
Sarah said, to Faith's point, if you want to discuss the thanatological aspect of the crime, I have some statistics.
Amanda never shut Sarah down the way she did with everyone else.
They are?
In 16% of serial murders, you see some form of post-mortem mutilation. Desecration falls at under 10%, necrophilia and cannibalism less than 5%. 3% of the time, there's posing of the body for some kind of shock value.
Amanda asked,
would you say Caterino and Truong were posed?
They were effectively paralyzed, but both found on their backs. We have to assume the killer posed them that way. Alexandra McAllister could have been left on her back, but the predators fought over her body, so she was moved post-mortem.
Okay.
Faith had to make a chart to keep track of this.
We've got 4 solid links between Humphrey, Truong, and McAllister. The hammer to the head, the blue Gatorade, the paralyzing, and the mutilation. Caterino had the hammer, the Gatorade, the paralyzing, but not the mutilation. Truong and Caterino were missing personal items, the headband and the banana clip, respectively.
Will said,
Gerald Caterino hedged on the missing headband. It could be that things were missing because things were missing.
Faith looked at the grid she'd drawn on the page. She silently checked through the other victims from Daryl Nesbitt's newspaper articles. She had to try one more time with Amanda.
She asked, can we just go there for a minute?
Amanda knew where the where was.
30 seconds.
You're telling us that we can't call this guy a serial killer. That we have a hunch but not concrete links because there's no evidence that he's killed 3 or more women, right?
Amanda looked at her watch.
So we've got 8 possible victims from the newspaper articles. In order to get evidence that they were murdered, and not all coincidentally a bunch of clumsy hikers,
We'd have to talk to the investigators and coroners and any witnesses on all of those cases, right?
She was still looking at her watch.
So? Faith punched out the word. Why aren't we talking to those coroners and witnesses and cops to ascertain whether or not there were more victims?
Amanda looked up from her watch. Right now, the number of victims is immaterial. We have a murderer. We know he's a murderer. We also have something that we seldom get in these situations, and that is the element of surprise. Nick said,
He doesn't know that we know he's still out there.
Correct, Amanda said. If we start knocking on the doors of 8 different jurisdictions that have anywhere from 10 to 50 different officers standing around looking for gossip, how long do you think that element of surprise will last?
Faith asked, But what do we lose?
What do we gain? Amanda countered. There are no autopsy reports because the deaths were not ruled suspicious. In half the cases, the bodies were cremated. No investigations were started, let alone completed. We already have access to the details of the women's disappearances. We already know where they were found, how long they were missing, their names, their addresses, their occupations, the names of their relatives. What more do you think we'll get?
Maybe one of the detectives was uneasy with the coroner's finding.
Weigh that against CNN following our every move. Or Fox doing a primetime special. Or the newspapers, or the reporters, or the police officers talking off the record about every finding or possible lead or suspect, Amanda said. Now, think about the killer watching those shows, hearing those leaks, adjusting his M.O., possibly going underground, or moving to another state where we have no contacts and no authority.
Faith couldn't articulate a defense, but she knew in her gut that talking to people was the best tool, sometimes the only tool a detective had.
Amanda said, We can discuss the newspaper articles in here, inside these walls, until you are blue in the face. But not one phone call gets made, not one source gets tapped without my permission. Understood?
Does it matter what I answer?
No,
Amanda said.
Dr. Linton, do you have anything further to share?
Sarah shook her head.
All right, let's get to the Gerald Catarino of it all,
Amanda said.
Faith, you're up. Please feel free to start with the articles.
Faith had planned to do just that, but she gave a heavy sigh that Emma would have been jealous of. She turned back through the pages in her notebook as she took Sarah's place at the podium. She felt like Barney Fife, following Charlize Theron. Sarah had done some kind of John Hughes nerd thing, where she'd slapped on some makeup, took off her glasses, and was suddenly Julia Roberts. Faith looked like what she was, a single mother who spent 90% of most mornings asking a 2-year-old how something got wet. Faith had spent half the night collating information and most of the morning on the phone, but she wasn't going to miss the opportunity to take a dig at Amanda.
All of this is scanned into the server if you want to dig into the details. But for now, we'll do exactly as Amanda ordered and start with the victims from the articles.
Amanda remained stoic.
Joan Feeney, Rennie Seeger, Pia Dansky, Charlene Driscoll, Deundra Baum, Shay Van Dorn, Bernadette Baker, Jessica Spivey.
Faith clicked the remote for the smart board, pulling up the images she had preloaded.
Gerald Catarino had copies of all the coroner's reports. As has been stated, no autopsies were performed on any of the victims because no foul play was suspected. Gerald spoke by phone or in person to friends and family members. He talked to some of the local investigators. Extrapolating from his notes, I think we can remove Seeger, Driscoll, Spivey, Baker, and Baum.
Because?
Amanda prompted.
Seeger had a history of suicide attempts. Driscoll was suffering from postpartum depression. Spivey was an obvious trip and fall. Baker had a jealous husband, and 2 even more jealous boyfriends.
bound round in shallow water, which is suspicious, but not our kind of suspicious.
Faith pointed to the remaining women.
Joan Feeney. The coroner's report states animal activity around her breasts, anus, and vagina. Pia Dansky. Animal activity, unspecified. Shay Van Doren. Animal activity in sex organs, according to the dentist who serves as a Duval County coroner.
Will provided.
Gerald Caterino didn't know about the mutilations, so he didn't ask.
Sarah said, as far as I know, Tommy never spoke about what happened to her, and Leslie Truong's case is technically still open, so it's not subject to a Freedom of Information request.
Correct,
Amanda verified.
Faith.
Faith did not appreciate being needled, but she clicked back to images she had culled from Gerald's murder wall. She said,
Pia Dansky's best friend reported that Pia was very worried because her grandmother's silver hairbrush was missing. Joan Feeney had to borrow a headband from a friend in exercise class because the one she always kept in her gym bag had gone missing. Shay Van Doren was driving in her car with her neighbor's daughter. The kid asked to borrow a comb. Van Doren seemed very concerned that the comb was missing. Also, according to Gerald, all three women reported independently to a friend or family member that they were feeling uneasy before their disappearance, as if they were being watched. So, without any of the bodies, we've got two connections. The missing hair accessories and the feeling of being stalked or watched prior to death.
Sarah asked, do you know the disposition of the bodies?
All but Van Doren were cremated.
Faith walked over to one of the boards.
Here's the important thing, though. There's a pattern to the three recent murders.
Amanda said,
we have no proof of murder.
Faith made a face.
Feeney, Dansky, and Van Doren. I ran through their social media profiles, checked dating sites, credit reports, addresses, all the usual stuff, but there's no connection. But then, I looked at the calendar. Feeney and Dansky both disappeared the last week of March. Van Doren disappeared the last week of October.
Sarah said, Tommy Humphrey was attacked the last week of October. Caterino and Truong were attacked in late March. Faith said,
and Alexandra McAllister was killed in October. We've got a murderer who averages two victims a year, roughly 5 to 7 months apart.
Amanda gave her another sharp look, because that sounded like a serial killer. Nick said,
the FBI profiler says that the killer thinks about what he's doing for a while. There's a fantasy element. Then something sets him off. Maybe he loses another job or his mother nags him about leaving his socks on the floor, so he pops off.
Hold on. I've got an update from the lab.
Amanda looked at her phone. She tapped the screen a few times, then silently read. Finally, she told them,
the GBI doesn't have a record of the Leslie Truong toxicology reports from Grant County 8 years ago.
Nick said,
we were still faxing back then. I might have a copy of my old files. The report would have gone from me to Brock with a CC to the chief.
Sarah said, it wasn't in his files. Amanda told Nick,
track it down.
He closed his briefcase and left. Sarah said, Brock should have a copy too.
Good,
Amanda said.
Rashid, go back to the prison and work on the Vasquez murder. Gary, you've still got your training wheels on. I need you out of here for this next part.
Yes, ma'am.
Gary closed his notebook. He left with Rashid. Amanda waited until the door was closed. She told Faith,
Heath Caterino.
Faith doubted Sarah and Will had talked about yesterday's revelation. So for Sarah's sake, she said,
Becky Caterino has a 7-year-old son. He'll turn 8 at Christmas.
Sarah bit her bottom lip. She had done the math. Faith told her about the letter Daryl Nesbitt had sent Gerald from prison.
Gerald supplied us with a DNA report off the saliva from the stamp and envelope seal. An AABB-accredited, court-recognized commercial lab ruled out Daryl Nesbitt as the father.
So, Sarah was clearly struggling to make sense of this new detail.
If Daryl isn't Heath's father, that means he wasn't the person who attacked Becky, which means he wasn't the person who attacked Leslie Truong.
Faith tried for the positive.
As soon as we find a suspect, we can prove he raped Becky through a paternity test that ties him to Heath.
Amanda said, "We can prove that he had sex with Becky around the time that she was attacked. Yes, she identified as a lesbian, but any defense lawyer worth his salt would challenge her fluidity. The truth won't matter. The girl is in no condition to say otherwise."
Faith leaned her elbows on the podium. She was getting tired of Amanda knocking them down. There were so many flashing signs that they were practically landing on the Vegas Strip.
Amanda picked up on her mood.
"Faith, you of all people should be familiar with taking baby steps. We move one foot, then we move the other. We don't jump across the room. Slow and steady builds the case. What about this Love to See Murder website?"
Faith paused to make her reluctance felt.
"According to the site, Dirk Masterson is a retired Detroit homicide cop. He moved to Georgia with his wife, who is a retired school teacher, because they wanted to be close to their 10 grandchildren. His invoices go to a post office box in Marietta. The city of Detroit has no record of an officer named Dirk Masterson. Meanwhile, he's built Gerald Catarino out of tens of thousands of dollars."
"Dirk Masterson," Amanda said. "Isn't that a porn name?"
None of them were comfortable with Amanda being the one to make this observation.
Faith said, "I filed a subpoena to Dirk's ISP so we can find out who he really is. I read some of his so-called case files. He sounds like a cop, like I sound like a chicken."
"I want you in his face by the end of the day."
Amanda added,
"Also, go back and look for women who were reported missing in the months of October and March over the last 8 years. Email me the list. I'll make some discreet phone calls."
Faith felt a glimmer of hope, but she knocked it back with sarcasm.
"Since we're not looking for a serial killer with a specific pattern, should I put out an alert for current reports of missing women, or women who've reported feeling like they've been watched?"
Amanda narrowed her eyes.
"Sure."
"Thanks."
Amanda turned back to Sarah.
"Do you think Tommy Humphrey will talk to us? She's the only living victim we have who can cogently provide information. It's been 9 years. Perhaps she's remembered something."
Sarah's reluctance was palpable. "I showed Nesbitt's book and photo to her the day he was arrested. For what it's worth, Tommy said it wasn't him. But later that day, she tried to hang herself in her parents' backyard. She was taken to a private hospital for treatment. The family moved out of Grant a year later."
Amanda said, "Tommy's attacker spoke to her. He promised not to hurt more women if she kept silent. We can infer that he had other conversations with her. Perhaps she remembered something, or more than likely she held something back."
"It's possible,"
Sarah allowed, but she was still visibly reticent. Amanda pressed,
"Would you be more amenable to reaching out to Tommy Humphrey if you could be the one to speak with her?"
Sarah deflected. She never looked at his face. She was drugged when it happened. She went into and out of consciousness. The medication alone could cause amnesia.
"She could remember the days or weeks leading up to the attack," Amanda said. "Did she feel like she was being watched? Was she missing anything that was important to her?"
Sarah's reluctance hadn't abated, but she said,
"I'll try."
Chapter 16. Gina Vogel could not shake that unsettling feeling of being watched. She had felt it at the gym. She had felt it at the grocery store. She had felt it at the post office. The only place she didn't feel it was inside of her house, and that was because she was keeping all of the blinds and curtains closed, even during the day. What was wrong with her? One missing scrunchie, and she was turning herself into Howard Hughes, sans the money, fame, and genius. Even her toenails were reaching Hughesian lengths. She had canceled her usual pedicure at the nail salon. The monthly appointments had started 2 years ago. There came a time in a woman's life when she was not to be trusted to safely clip her own toenails. That time was when she needed reading glasses to see the finer details of her own damn feet. Was she really too scared to leave the house? Gina put her hand to the back of her neck. The hairs stood at attention. She had goosebumps on her arms. She was talking herself into a nervous breakdown because of one missing scrunchie, and a general feeling that a madman was stalking her, based on absolutely no proof, except a bad feeling and too many hours of watching murder documentaries. She had to get out of this house. Gina walked to the front door. She was wearing her day pajamas, but none of her neighbors were home, at least none that she liked. She would walk to the mailbox and check her mail like a normal person. She stepped down the concrete steps to the front stoop. She saw a car drive by. Acura. Dark green. Mom in the front. Kid in the back. Normal stuff. No big deal. Just a family going to school or to a doctor's appointment. Never mind the woman in stylish pajamas, carefully stepping down from her own front door like a namby-pamby fool, dipping her toe into the pool because she was afraid of jumping in. Gina took another step down. She was on the walkway. Then she was turning right onto the sidewalk. Then she was standing in front of her mailbox. Her hand felt trembly as she took out her mail. The pile was filled with the usual detritus: coupons, catalogs, circulars. She found her credit card bill, which would be depressing, and a political campaign postcard, which was infuriating. The glossy magazine from her alma mater was a surprise. Gina had been blocked from the official Facebook page after she had posted that the theme for their 20th reunion should be fucked, married, killed. The magazine started to shake, but that was only because Gina had started to shake too. She felt the freakout steaming through her nerves like a boiling tea kettle. Her hand went to the back of her neck again. She sputtered out a breath. Her lungs went rigid. She couldn't get enough air. She knew that someone was watching her. Was he standing behind her? Had she heard footsteps? Could she hear a man walking toward her now, his arms outstretched as he reached for her neck? Shit, she whispered. Her entire body was shaking, yet somehow her legs would not move. She felt her bladder start to ache. She closed her eyes. She forced herself to spin around. No one. Shit! She said the word louder this time. She walked back toward her house. She kept looking over her shoulder like a crazy person. She wondered if the woman who lived across the street had been watching her. The nosy Nelly was always in everybody's business. She wrote long screeds on the Next Door app about people leaving their trash cans out on the street and not properly separating their recycling. If she wasn't careful, someone was going to slap some deli meat on her Nissan Leaf, and then it would jump off like the sharks in the Jets. Gina's knee almost buckled as she leapt up the front stairs. She slammed the door behind her. The mail dropped from her hands and scattered onto the floor. She fumbled with a deadbolt. She didn't lock it. The door had been open while she was outside. Had someone sneaked in? She had spun like a top at the mailbox. Her back was to the front door for several seconds. Someone could have slipped inside. Someone could be inside the house right now. Shit! She rushed to check window and door locks, looking in closets and under beds, because that was just how insane she was lately.
Was this what it felt like to go stir crazy? She went back to the couch. She grabbed her iPad. She Googled, symptoms of being stir crazy. A quiz came back. 1. Are you moody? 2. Have you lost interest in sex? 3. Do you feel anxious or restless? 4. Are you overtired or sleepy during the day? She checked yes on every question because her vibrator couldn't read. The result. You are at risk of developing depression. Have you considered speaking with a therapist? I have located 4 different specialists in Stir Crazy in your area. Gina let the iPad fall back to the couch. Now the internet knew that she was depressed. She was probably going to be inundated with spam and ads for natural cures and supplements to improve her mood. She didn't need a pill. She needed to get a hold of herself. Paranoia was not her personality type. She was goal-oriented, a self-starter, highly organized, methodical. She socialized often, but she was as equally pleased with her own company. She was all of the things that a different quiz had told her were good qualities when 2 years ago she Googled, "Am I the type of person who can work from home?" Gina had easily transitioned away from the office, but she had quickly determined that she needed a reason to occasionally shave her legs and wash her hair. Her 2 outlets were the gym, which she hit at least 3 times a week, and lunch dates, which she tried to schedule at least 2x a month. She pulled up her calendar on her iPad. To her surprise, she saw that she had not been out of the house in 6 days. Canceled lunch plans, skipped workouts, missed work meetings. Instead of rectifying the situation with a burst of phone calls, she started strategizing. Between Postmates and Instacart, she could eke out another week before she would be forced to leave the house. That was when her 12-year-old boss wanted her in the office for a video conference with clients in Beijing. Gina would definitely have to put on clothes with buttons and zippers and actually show up because "I accidentally fed a mogwai after midnight" was an excuse that only worked on 12-year-old boys in the year 1985. She stared at the squares on the calendar. Another week would extend her confinement to a total of 13 days. 13 days was nothing. People took 13-day lunches in France. She had lasted almost 13 days on the Atkins diet. In college, she had eaten ramen noodles for a hell of a lot longer than 13 days. Hell, she had pretended to have vaginal orgasms with various boyfriends for 13 years. She got up from the couch. She went into the kitchen. She opened the fridge. 4 tomato slices in a Ziploc bag, 26 cans of Diet Coke, a cucumber of obscene proportions, a half-eaten Kind bar. If the cops looked in her fridge, they would think she was a serial killer. She found a pad of paper and pen in the drawer. She started a grocery list for Instacart. She could make soups, chowders, even casseroles. She had downloaded tons of meditation apps that she'd always been too stressed out to open. There was that book she'd put off reading, the one everyone was talking about. She could download that book. She could read it like a person who reads books. She could burn the midnight oil and get her presentation for Beijing finished ahead of time. She would power through this unsettling freakout by eating healthy meals, keeping herself fit, reading, sleeping, and doing all of the self-care that was clearly lacking in her life. Sunlight. That was what she needed. Her mother used to chide her when she was a little girl. Get your nose out of that book and go outside. Gina could bring the outside in. She opened the blinds in the living room. She looked out into the street, which was a normal street, without a scary man watching her house. She opened the curtains in her bedroom. She went back into the kitchen and opened the door for some fresh air. She leaned over the sink to unlock the window. What she really needed to do was call Nancy. Her sister would shake her out of this.
and she would remember the pink scrunchie, and she would hopefully not tell her daughter that Gina had stolen it, because right now, Gina could not handle a screeching howler monkey telling her she was the worst aunt on the planet. She felt her bubble burst. Nancy was her older sister, a natural-born, bossy busybody. Worse, she wanted to be her daughter's best friend, which had worked out just as awesomely as you'd expect. Gina tried to refill the bubble. Nancy would not tell her daughter about the scrunchie. She would come over with a bottle of wine, and they would laugh about how stupid Gina had been, and they would watch home remodeling shows on TV, where 25-year-old Canadians had saved a $100,000 down payment to buy a house, while the recent item in Gina's search history was, is it safe to eat the part of the bread that does not have mold on it? She looked down at the empty bowl on the windowsill. The scrunchie had been there, and now it wasn't. Gina knew that she had not misplaced it, because she was not a misplacer. She was an exact placer, as in she was highly organized, methodical, and tidy. Which was why, according to one quiz, she would be a really good candidate for working from home.
Fuck me.
Gina's fingers twisted the window lock back into place. She would not call Nancy. She would not tell her sister any of this.